And you are listening to KRUI 89.7, Iowa City's Sound Alternative. This is Bijou Banter with your hosts, Sam McCrory. And with me today, we have Molly Bagnall, Eli Boonenbale, and our guest, Cara Saravelli. How are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Thanks. Tell us a little about yourself.
So I'm a third year. I'm an English and creative writing major with a minor in American Studies. Yeah, probably see me in the EPB.
She does it all, folks.
That sounded almost like a rap lyric.
Yeah.
Like, catch me in the EPB outside.
Catch me there.
Yeah.
And this is going to be our last, possibly last show of the year.
It will certainly be my last show.
Yeah, Eli's last show of the year. Maybe our last of 2018. Me and Molly are still debating on possibly maybe doing a show next week and talk about the best of 2018 since we're about to leave for break here at the University of Iowa. But today, for our possible last show and for Eli's last show, we're going to stack three films all together. We usually do two a week, but this week we got a little courageous.
We're doing
to do three.
Old school style.
Old school
style.
We
always used to talk about three films.
But we got lazy.
Yeah. We were younger then.
I like to think responsible with our time.
Yeah. But now we're back up to three. And the three films we're going to talk about today here on Bijou Banter is the 2018 film Wildlife, the 2018 film The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and the 1999 film But I'm a Cheerleader. And first off, we're going to start off with Wildlife. Like I said, that is a 2018 film directed by first-time director and still an actor, Paul Dano.
Until further notice.
Yeah, he has an actor. I don't think he's been anything in a while. But if you don't know Paul Dano, he was kind of made his really big star role in Little Miss Sunshine. And then he went off to do There'll Be Blood. And
Husband to Zoe Kazan,
yeah,
who is the gal who got rattled in Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Who also co-wrote the film.
Who also co-wrote Wildlife.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. And directed by Paul Dano, co-written by him and Zoe Kazan, who is his partner. And it is based off a book by Richard Ford, which was written in the 90s. And the film follows a family who just moves to Montana, mainly seen through the eyes of a 14-year-old boy named Joe. And he basically watches his parents' marriage kind of collapse once his father leaves to go fight the wildfires in Montana. And you see his mother, she has some struggles once Joe's father leaves the house, and she's kind of going through this sort of crisis. Both parents are kind of going through some sort of a crisis. So let's start here, left to right. Molly, what do you think of Wildlife?
I really like this film a lot. I thought it kind of went beyond what I maybe expected from a film about like a family falling apart or a film about a like son watching his parents divorce. I thought like the emotions that like it conveyed were like a lot more complex, where it's not, I think it would be really easy for like a lesser film to just make a villain out of Carey Mulligan's character. And like, both as a credit to the writing of the film, mm-hmm. and also like Carey Mulligan as an actress, it is like really complex. Her character is very so good. Like, and I think it's significant that even though Joe is like the ostensible like main character in the film, Carey Mulligan is the one that is first billed. And I think that's like one really interesting, because I feel like, I was thinking about this after I saw it, that this film kind of falls in line with a lot of films I've seen recently that are about like these really like emotional, like heart-wrenching topics.
But family struggles.
Yeah, family struggles.
But
the main character is like kind of blank and boring and doesn't have like a lot to like add, but then all of the emotional weight rests on like the side characters. It's almost, I like, compared to like Nick Carraway from The Great Gatsby.
Yeah, and I didn't get to this, but Carey Mulligan plays the mother. Her name is Jeanette, and Jake Gyllenhaal is Joe's father, whose name is Jerry, and then Ed Oxnabold, who is in the terrible, whatever that, the Alex in the Very Bad Day, he was in that adaptation, and he plays Joe.
So, and he looks like Paul Dano.
He does look like Paul Dano.
He looks exactly like Paul Dano. He cast a little boy who looks like Paul Dano.
Carla,
Paul Dano
thoughts?
Has a very guppy-like face.
Carla, your thoughts?
I don't know if I can top that. I don't know. My initial sort of reaction to it wasn't that great, just because maybe I was a little bit too eager to view it through the eyes of Joe and to see it as part of that sort of like of those conventions of like the broken home, the regional like American novel. I guess like for me, like maybe it was harder for me to like catch on to like what, you were talking about Molly with like Carey Mulligan's performance, which I still thought was like great, but overall I kind of felt like, I don't know, overall felt kind of familiar to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can really elaborate on that.
Yeah, I fall more on Kara's side than on Molly's. I found this to be a somewhat flavorless Oedipal saga, and it's very interesting to me, Molly's reading of Carey Mulligan's character as being complex enough to in some way be sympathetic or powerful, because I did not have that reading. I do think she puts in a very good performance. I think Carey Mulligan is almost kind of clinically incapable of doing anything other than performing very well mm-hmm. in almost everything she's in. I think Jake Gyllenhaal is actually pretty bad in this movie. I think he's pretty terrible.
Boy, boy, boy.
Boy, boy, boy.
I actually liked that part.
It is wildlife that we are in now, isn't it?
I like that part.
He did name drop the movie.
It's a crazy enough line that I kind of enjoyed it, but I just think throughout the film he's a little flat, especially when he's acting off of her, because she's so much better than him in this movie.
That's true.
And I do think that Jake Gyllenhaal can be incredibly good. I think he's incredible in Nightcrawler. I think he's incredible in Brokeback Mountain. I think he's putting in a pretty subpar performance here. And I feel that that extends to a lot of the complaints that I had about the film. It just felt like this is a director who's a first-timer who has less of a vision and more of kind of a game plan. Everything about sort of the use of off-screen space and the construction of specific shots feels very tactical, very cold and distant to me. I did not connect with this film. There's something that just wasn't clicking for me.
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, I thought this film was actually really fantastic. It was maybe one of... And some of the last movies we've seen opening at Film City, I think this has been one of my favorites that I've seen over the last couple weeks. Just because I wasn't really taken away by Beautiful Boy. I wasn't really taken away by Boy Erased.
And Beautiful Boy Erased.
Beautiful Boy Erased, yeah. And I don't know, I really enjoyed this film. I like the line that they walk of this kind of teetering crisis in the family. Where, you know, I feel like Paul Dano walks a good line where none of the characters really go overboard into a general flat-out crisis where they're, you know, I feel like there is mm-hmm. some points of they're trying to do right by their child and they're trying to do right by their marriage. I feel like there's not a huge tipping point. I feel like he walks the line of crisis really, really well in this film.
But I would say, at least from my experience of the film, in service of trying to achieve a film that is not cliched or not totally melodramatic, I feel like what happens instead is that you end up with a fairly stilted, crafted piece where a lot of the dialogue felt very writerly to me. The performances are nuanced and there is something here. I don't think it's necessarily a terrible film. I really felt like I couldn't connect with it at points. And I felt like whatever interesting formal flourishes it did perform, there are certain scenes where characters kind of wander in and out of the frame and dialogue is sort of muffled. And there's some clever play happening at points, but it just felt off. And I will also say that I did tend to find the portrayal of Carey Mulligan's character sort of latently sexist at points. I thought there's this scene where Joe goes into her bedroom after she's had sex with this wealthy car car salesman, and the way the camera just kind of lingers like it's a horror movie over the scene of the crime, it feels very judgmental to me in a very melodramatic way that I think at other times the film restrains from, but there were moments where it verged on a somewhat retrograde model of looking at this woman that I didn't feel matched with her performance, which is otherwise quite sympathetic.
Molly, what'd you think?
I think that to Eli's point that he just made about Carey Mulligan's character, I feel like there is it. I think it walks a line between being sympathetic and being like this outright condemnation of this woman. But I feel like it errs more on sympathy just because of the overly, at least to me, overly apparent like total breakdown that Carey Mulligan's character is going through, like for the whole thing, that it becomes it's very difficult for me to like view this film as any like and her character as anything more than like watching like a woman go through like heart-wrenching pain and reacting in the only way that like she feels she can with the only way that she knows how. And so then the scene like that he's referenced, that Eli just referenced, of like the like scene of the crime
where Joe figures out his mother's having an affair,
I think that it is kind of shot like a horror film, but like because it's Joe's like he knows what his mother's doing. It's like, it is horrifying for him. Mm-hmm. And Like, but then right after that, it's followed up by a scene of Carrie Mulligan's character saying that she wants to die. And then towards the end, Jake Gyllenhaal's character says, "I think I'm wasted on you." And she says, "I think so too." Like, moments like that really, like, cut through and just, for me, like, really let me know that this is not, like, oh, look how selfish she's being. Like, look, she's, like, whoring herself out, or she... Can I say that?
Yeah, I think okay. so.
And she's, like, having this, like, affair while he's off fighting a wildfire. Like, it becomes, like, she's really paranoid that her husband is having an affair with, like,
with some someone, woman, out,
with someone yeah. out in the wildfire. Like, I think he has a woman out here. Men either go crazy or there's a woman. Those are the only two options. So, like, her worldview is, like, extremely limited. And because of that limited worldview, she, like, literally just kind of, like, loses it in a way. And then, but we also get the, like, she's, like, having a complete mental, like, breakdown, but then is also trying so hard to, like, take care of her son, mm-hmm. because now she's the only person that her son has, and she's, like, the whole movie is her trying to, for, like, the majority of the film, actually, like, it's just her trying to balance, like, her own degrading mental health with taking care of her son, and also
trying to provide,
and all of this, because there's also, like, as soon as her husband leaves, she's like, I have to go do everything. I have to take care of all of this myself. She puts enormous pressure on herself. So, like, I thought, like, that aspect of the film was, like, so brilliant. And it, like, is what tipped this film into, like, being, like, a film that I really, really enjoyed watching.
Yeah, and I think when you first gave your kind of starting points about the film, Molly, you brought up a point which I walked away from, where the film tries to make her look like a villain. And one of the parts, because she does have an affair.
Yeah. I don't think the film wants her to be a villain.
No, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's almost...
But it comes off a little bit like she's
I think
doing
it frames
wrongdoing.
It a lot. What bothered me about it is that I think a lot of the reading that you're performing on this particular aspect of the film, I think is there and is available, but the film and the camera takes a fairly ambivalent position towards her and allows for... I think just as valid of a more judgmental or sexist or degrading reading. Not that I think that the film endorses that, mm-hmm. but I feel like often the way that it's framed is through the eyes of the child, to the extent that sometimes it feels as if the film is saying, look what it's doing to him. Look at how her choices are affecting him. And that was the point where I kind of got off the bus. I kind of felt like I was a little bit checked out.
So really getting back to the point that I was trying to make there, when he leaves, cause you, at least when I left the film, when I left the theater, I was thinking, man, this kid does have a rough, but you kind of, at least in some, maybe some people's headspace, they're thinking, well, is it Jake Gyllenhaal's problem that he left and abandoned his family sort of, or is it Carrie Mulligan's problem that she cheated on her husband and kind of brought a little more crisis there? And I think the film balanced it out pretty well of they're not blaming one parent over the other. Because I think you can make arguments that Jake Gyllenhaal was just zoned out, and after he lost his job, he just wanted to leave again. And it kind of puts the blame a little bit on Carrie Mulligan's character because she is self-combusting this relationship.
Yeah. I also think it's interesting because, like, at the whole, like, first 40 or so minutes of the film is very, like, apparent that Jake Gyllenhaal is the... like, the lesser parent. It's, like, what the film is, like, getting at. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as, like, he leaves, and then it's, like, Carrie Mulligan's turn to be the lesser parent. But then, like, I feel like there's a tendency, like, myself included, to, like, really hyper-fixate on Carrie Mulligan being, like, a bad mother more than Jake Gyllenhaal.
But I don't think she's a bad mother.
I don't think she's a bad mother either. I don't know.
I think the film sometimes scolds her. I think the
it does. And, like, I mean, rightfully so.
Of him having to make dinner for himself and worrying about where his mother is when he comes home and stuff.
Honestly, I got a little, when that whole, right after Jake Gyllenhaal's character left, I kind of thought of We the Animals a little bit. Mm. Where these characters, where Joe's character was kind of doing what the three boys and We the Animals did, where they're like, oh, well, our mom isn't doing much. Well, let's take care of ourselves. And then it kind of puts a little more camera time on Joe. That's what I thought of, at least in this part.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very fair comparison.
Yeah. Yeah. Carla, do you have any thoughts on Carrie Mulligan?
Yeah, I mean, like, my takeaway, too, was, like, yeah, Jake Gyllenhaal's character single-handedly ruined this marriage. I don't know. I'm biased against him, for sure. But, like, her laying in bed after he leaves, and it's definitely not made light of early on, like, that she is, like, very, very lonely, mm-hmm. and he just doesn't seem to have any, like, real understanding of, like, the emotional ties of, like, being in a family, and so he just, like, up and disappears, and so, like, it was very hard for me to really, like, blame her, but I agree that, like, the question of what Joe's, like, perspective is doing makes it sort of ambiguous as to whether we're supposed to, like, sympathize with her or see mm-hmm. her as a villain.
Well, and Mulligan also has this performance of, and this is why I said earlier it's a very Oedipal drama. There's, like, this very tight triangle around the mommy, daddy, king, baby thing that's happening here, mm-hmm. where she overperforms and is overly open about her emotional vulnerability with her child. She'll talk about how we haven't been having sex a lot lately, and she'll make out with the man she's having an affair with in front of her child in this kind of spectacular display. And all of that, I think, comes to the head in this kind of clever, but I found a little bit contrived metaphor with the camera, where they're all sort of propped up in front of the camera at the end of the film where he works.
Yeah.
Where he's, you know, he's told earlier he gets this job to support his family that he's told by the man who runs the store that we take photographs so that people can sort of entomb these happy moments and keep them preserved for when they won't be happy later.
Yeah.
And so the end of the film is this somewhat writerly scenario wherein he gets his parents back together so that he can
take this happy moment, this photograph.
And there's, you know, there's this psychoanalytic concept of propping up that a lot of psychoanalytically influenced critics are kind of drawn to in film, that we prop ourselves up to create displays for our own subjectivity that don't really match with who we actually are. And I think, like, a lot of people who are prone to psychoanalysis will probably pick this film apart quite easily based on a lot of the looking relations and familial relations that are established in this film. But I found it a little bit rote and color by numbers at points. And the relationship that the mother has with the son in this film, I think, ultimately, there was just some kind of abrasion that came between myself and the film, mm-hmm. and I wasn't ultimately really drawn to it because of that.
Yeah. Psychoanalytics aside, the one thing I did not like about this film...
The greatest sentence ever uttered. We should say it daily.
The one thing I really... Why this film is not as great as I think it could be is the way it handles time in this timeline here. Because I was really thinking, how long was Jake Gyllenhaal's character gone?
Yeah, because it does kind of feel like
it's been a week.
It really does kind of feel like
it was the day after that he left that she started having an affair. Yeah.
And then there's an epilogue tacked on for the last, like, 10 minutes of the film.
That's like a year later.
She says that he's grown. It's been long enough that he has physically changed.
I don't know. I just didn't understand how, because they're mentioning, because for those listening, Jake Gyllenhaal was out to fight these wildfires, and he comes back when the first snow comes, because obviously the snow will.
I'm like, this is beside the point, but I know that first snow, it's like less than an inch. That's not going to put out a wildfire. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Maybe it's different in Montana, though, you know? But I don't know. I just didn't like the way they handled time in this film. Because I think you guys make a point here where it feels like he leaves and it's been a week.
And everything goes to hell.
And I think no later than a month and he comes back and everything's just chaotic. And I was like, I don't know. Maybe this is just...
Yeah, I also think that might... bring, like, having a better grasp on, like, how time is passing and how much time is passing would also, like, give more to, like, the Carrie Mulligan character.
Yeah, because...
if you're like, oh, it's been a day and she's freaking out like this,
yeah.
I think it's very different than if it's like it's
three
been
months.
Like three
yeah.
months yeah
but I mean I was thinking about this my dad went away for about a month to maybe 2 months when Katrina happened to do Red Cross stuff. And so I have a similar experience where you have a parent go away for a while. And I don't know this, I don't remember that really well, but obviously my mom didn't have an affair.
That you know.
That I know of, yeah. Hope, knock on wood.
Sam's mom.
Hi, Sam's
listening.
Mom.
anyway, I kind of drew on that and I thought, a month is not that long of a time. And it seemed like a month to me.
Speaking of time passing, because we're doing three films, I think
we should.
One last thing. I really like the way this film was shot.
Yeah. Montana.
I really like the way that this film was shot. Me and Carla, we saw this together. We both cringed when Miller put the cigar in his mouth, and it's like this really grotesque, like low angle.
I think there's like these weirdly digitally enhanced, like
I did not care focus, for the soft focus. The focus and like the random parts. It was just like looks this looks like an airbrushed toddler that's yeah. being put up for like a pageant.
I will also say there's a handful of shots in the film when he's working at the photo,
the camera shop,
the camera shop that are supposed to replicate like the portrait photography. And there are similar shots in The Master, the Paul Thomas Anderson one.
Okay.
And those ones are much better. I'm sorry. That's all I was going to say. Every time I
saw
it,
you're comparing
like,
Paul Thomas Anderson to Paul Dano as his first directed.
Paul Dano's been in Paul Thomas Anderson films.
That's true. He has.
Battle of the Pauls.
Yeah.
Anyway. So. Yeah. I mean, you bring up the point how the movie is kind of beautifully shot. Obviously, Montana lends its landscape to the camera. And, you know, if you've ever been to Montana,
so
it's amazing landscape. Yeah.
Yeah.
Final thoughts?
For
I like
me,
it.
Yeah.
Go
for me, at
it.
Least, I think it's a very solid film. I think it got underrepresented. It hasn't really got any.
It was at Sundance.
Yeah.
It got some buzz at Sundance, but that was quite
didn't
a while
get any
ago.
Buzz. Any? We'll see how it fares coming up award seasons, but probably not too well since it's probably gonna get a wide release. Carla?
Not ecstatic, but I think it's good.
Yeah, not ecstatic, and I don't think it's that good. I don't think it's terrible, but I would skip it.
Yeah.
I would go see it just for Carey Mulligan, even if you don't.
I do like
Carey
Mulligan.
It is one of those ones where it's kind of going to be like, can you ever forgive me? Where you maybe go see it just for the performance, because Melissa McCarthy's having this kind of great review of her performance, and so is Carey Mulligan.
In general, I'm not drawn so much to that type of film just for that, so I think that might explain part of why.
For
I'm
other layman viewers who aren't. Yeah. Cinematic art
me,
studies
an
professors. Anyway, let's get into our conversation on Wildlife. Like I said, that is a 2018 film directed by Paul Dano. The film is no longer playing at Film Scene. I believe when we saw it, that was the second to last night it was going to be there. So that is no longer at Film Scene. I don't know where else it's going to show. So if you want to go see it.
Boy, boy, boy.
Boy, boy, boy. If you want
to
go see
it. Out.
Yeah, you're going to be.
Hunted down.
SOL. But we are going to move on and do a quick little discussion of But I'm a Cheerleader, which played last night, a part of our Bijou five-year anniversary film. Bijou Film Board voted on But I'm a Cheerleader to be played a part of our Bijou's five-year anniversary with Film Scene. Like I said, in the beginning of the show, it's a 1999 film directed by Jamie Babbitt, and it's our third... No, not it's our,
it's,
third
it's our third
conversion therapy movie of the year.
Yes.
It has to be some sort of record for public radio.
Yeah. The saddest record
Call
ever
Guinness.
Set.
Let's get a plaque put up here. Anyway, the film stars Natasha Lyonne. I could not remember her name last week.
It's okay. Neither could Jack Christensen at the screening. He kept calling
really?
Her Saoirse Ronan, which is not at all the same.
Saoirse Ronan would have been like 2 years old.
Yeah. Like Saoirse Ronan,
Anyway, Natasha Lyonne plays a high schooler named Megan who is sent to a gay conversion therapy program by her parents, and it's...
You forgot the most important detail.
Starring
she is a cheerleader.
She's a cheerleader, and that's a great line she says in the film. She's sent away to this conversion therapy camp where RuPaul Charles is the...
Out of drag.
Out of drag, yes, is a counselor sort of thing at this conversion therapy camp. The film also stars Kathy Moriarty as the other conversion therapy, like the head of the conversion therapy camp. Also stars a couple other interesting characters, like Clay Duvall, who was in Girl Interrupted, which we saw earlier this year. Melanie Lynskey, who's been in a couple indie dramas of the last couple years. And that's kind of the big stars there.
Do you know who the actress who plays the head cheerleader that Megan has a crush on is? It's Michelle Williams.
Is it Michelle? Yeah,
it's Michelle
Williams. I saw that in when I was
the
doing
Michelle Williams. Yeah,
I saw that when I was doing my research, and I was like, Michelle Williams is in this movie
for like 2 minutes.
Also, the guy who voices Zuko in Avatar: Avatar The Last Airbender is in this movie.
What?
Who? Wait, what?
Yeah, the guy.
Is he Rock?
No, he's the wrestler. He's the wrestler guy.
Wait,
can we talk about Rock? I mean, I feel like our discussion of this is not.
Can we talk about Avatar: The Last Airbender for a second? No.
Yeah. I feel like we don't have to get into the plot too much, especially since we have retread
plot. She gets sent to the conversion therapy camp, some
falls
stuff goes down.
Yeah. Falls above.
It's really the biggest divergence of this film from the other two is that it's really, really funny.
It's really campy, funny.
And she becomes part of a like militant gay activism
group,
guerrilla warfare tactical
in
unit.
The movie,
that really just consists of asking someone to come with them and then getting in a car.
I'm gonna say this because I think maybe we all have the same view of this film, but does anyone have any negative Any qualms with this movie at all?
I have to say I was a little bit apprehensive going in the first time I saw this film. Not because I think it was going to be bad, but I thought it would just be kind of like campy on purpose in a way that doesn't always work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's not. And I don't even think I would describe this film as necessarily campy. It takes up visual tropes of campiness, yeah. And it looks a little bit John Watersy at points, but it actually is just very sweet. It has silliness to it, and it's very artificial at moments, but I don't know if it necessarily falls into the camp genre. It's not ironic enough.
Yeah, what Eli is alluding to is when they first go to the conversion therapy camp, all the people who are there have to wear these, they wear pink, and they wear... And then if they're
They have all these training sets that are like painted in all one uniform color.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds
very campy.
Yeah. And their last ceremony, they're wearing like plastic suits and plastic dresses, which just looks
horrible.
I love
that final scene.
It's so good.
Okay. I think the final scene when she gets in the cheerleading outfit and she does the little cheer to get her girlfriend back, I think is genuinely so sweet and nice. And I really, really like it.
And
that's when feminism was actually invented. And that is true.
I don't know if I can say this on air either, but the gay bar that they go to is called the Cocksucker. So
yeah,
love it.
A little campy there too, but
really good. Yeah. It's really funny. It was maybe the most fun after hours.
Oh,
film
I bet it was a
I've
blast.
Ever been to. Yeah. Yeah, me and Carla went to.
Had
see
Had you
this.
Seen it before?
No.
Oh yeah,
never.
How was the turnout?
It was about. I don't know. I'm really bad
I'm
at
sorry,
this. It was like about like
Molly sits in the
a
front,
little bit more
so.
Than half.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and I always sit in the front.
True.
But like it was really fun. Everyone was like just talking back and like laughing and making like their own jokes. And I feel because I watch so many movies that are very, very serious, I find myself becoming less and less inclined to like go to a movie late to see a very serious film, especially because I'm at like the end of like this semester, I'm like, I've seen so many movies that it was really nice to just go to a movie and just like just laugh and make jokes, and it was really, really fun.
And that's why we have movies like this, and that's why we have John Waters movies where you're like, this is just insane and hilarious.
Well, what I would say attendant to that is that this is a type of film that invites a community within
for
the viewing
sure.
Exactly.
Space.
And I would say the same thing for Tu Wong Fu, which we talked about last
week,
is the same way, is that it's kind of like the definition of like the cinema experience that you sit down and then the film is something that like happens to you, or it happens and you watch it and then, but you're not really invited in to like respond to the film in the moment that you're watching it. You're supposed to watch it all and then respond to it in like this intellectual like discussion way. But Tu Wong Fu and But I'm a Cheerleader both, like, as it's happening, you are like invited to like partake in like the film experience itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
Carla, what's your?
I have no qualms, no jokes. I loved it. I don't know.
Is this your first time seeing it?
Yeah, it was like interesting. I don't know. Interesting how like lately the whole thing happened with like pornography on Tumblr, because that's a film that's like posted about so much and screenshots of it show up so much, sort of like in the guise of it being this really like pretty aesthetic film. And so I was actually kind of surprised that it was so almost like deliberately garish with the colors and the coordinated outfits and everything. But had a great time. Cannot complain.
I think the word that comes to mind that was on the tip of my tongue when Molly was talking to you is that it's a very raunchy film. And it's raunchy not just in subject matter, but in attitude. That it is bouncy and attitudinal and sassy, but in a very natural way that makes sense for the topic at hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, like, when you're talking about sort of conditioning a spectator to not respond, or to, you know, we're all alone together in the theater, there's something about cinema that I often feel is missing now that used to be a very normal part of going to the theater, especially like in the silent era, where people were not conditioned to receive this, you know, with total solemnitude and silence. Cinema can be this kind of silly, bouncy funhouse. And I do feel like we can miss that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely love
that. Yeah, it's a good fun time.
Experience. Tu Wong Fu and this back-to-back were just really, really good programming on Sal, our programming director's part. It was really great.
Yeah.
And we won pom-pom. Carla won pom-poms. And then after the movie, we both went to Gabe's and we danced with the pomp. They were a
Did
hit.
You go like 1, 2, 3, 4? No. You're the one that I adore.
No.
5, 6, 7, 8. Leave this place because it's fake. I think the cheer she does at the end is great. I think it's really, really sweet.
I think
really
she's a bad cheerleader, though.
She is a bad cheerleader.
She's very slow.
Yeah. Michelle Williams, great cheerleader.
Oh my God. All right.
And great at everything. I love her.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about RuPaul, too, in this movie. And I think it's really fun to watch.
Like, brilliant.
Yeah. My favorite part is when they I would maybe consider RuPaul's character in this movie a he. I think
Well, RuPaul,
he's always
RuPaul,
he's always, always a he
as a man in real life.
Or he grabs his crotch and just
he's a he.
And he grabs his crotch is my favorite part.
It's a bit of stunt casting, but it plays because he's not really an actor.
No, yeah. I mean he was also in Tu Wong Fu and like
Hot
that.
Second.
Yeah. And I just think it's really great. Because like, that's the kind of casting that I actually took issue with Boy Erased for this. But I think...
Oh, with Troye Sivan.
Yeah, with Troye Sivan. Is that...
Oh boy, howdy did you.
I complained to anyone who would listen about my complaints of Troye Sivan. And where like in... But I'm a Cheerleader, they cast RuPaul, who's like this famous like gay icon, to play like an anti-gay person. And I think it like really works to the film's advantage. But in Boy Erased, they cast Troye Sivan, another like gay icon, or up and coming like gay singer who like being gay is like so closely aligned with his fame that it just is like, it was not good casting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I had to say.
As Molly ends her
anti-Troye
Sivan in Boy Erased.
That's gonna end our conversation. We didn't really, before we got on the show, we didn't want to take a lot of time to talk about But I'm a Cheerleader, because there's not really you know, really in-depth theme to talk about here. It's just a good fun
go
bouncy
see
film.
Yeah, yeah, see it.
I think
put it on
it
at like a sleepover with your friends.
Oh yeah, that's perfect.
It's great.
So that's gonna end our conversation
Pure
on
great cinema.
But I'm a Chef's Cheerleader. Kiss. That ends our Bijou After Hours programming as well. It's been a fun year with Bijou After Hours. We've basically covered, I think, maybe every film we've talked about. Except for, I think, Atomic Blonde, but
yeah, whatever. That was by choice.
Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back here on KRUI 89.7. And we are back here on KRUI FM 89.7. This is Bijou Banter. And our last film we're going to talk about tonight is going to be The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yeehaw.
Like I said, that is a 2018 film directed, written, and produced by Joel and Ethan Coen, the Coen brothers. It's a 6-part anthology Western film that basically starts off as a book, and then it goes through every chapter of this book called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and other stories and along the lines like that. Each little anthology, each little story has a different title and different cast of characters. I don't think they combine at all. No,
no.
Did
I don't
anyone
think
pick
we
up
even...
on any?
No, there's no crossover.
Yeah, there's
it's
no
just,
crossover.
It's like campfire stories.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And interestingly, the format of the turning pages of the book, I feel, is very directly appropriated from the second season of Fargo, which the Coen brothers produced. I don't think they had any creative hand in.
But they originally directed
the
Fargo.
The second season of Fargo has. You know that Fargo is a television show. Molly's looking at me like I've lost my mind. Do you know that Fargo is a television show on FX?
No, because my first reaction when I saw the book was the, you know, in like Disney movies when they open the book.
Yeah,
that's what I was preparing myself to hear you say.
The other
Shrek.
Yeah.
Isn't there a book in Shrek?
Yeah, there is.
The other big one to go to would be Howard Hawks' Red River, which is a foundational Western and also does do that.
Wait, is that the one where they shoot the cans? With the,
yes.
Which, oh, okay. Yeah, I was trying to trying to remember the name of this movie in my discussion.
With Montgomery Clift and he and the other sexy cowboy are holding guns and they go, mine's bigger.
Okay. Oh. I'll email my TA and I'll be like, I remember the name of that movie. It's Red River.
Hot.
Anyway.
Montgomery Clift is so hot. Oh my God.
The film has a couple of Coen brothers regulars like Tim Blake Nelson, who is Buster Scruggs. Some other notable names in this film. James Franco's in this as well. Steven Root, who he's a pretty prominent character actor. Liam Neeson is in it as well. Tom Waits, actor,
Hell
musician
yeah.
Tom Waits. Zoe Kazan, who wrote Wildlife, if you're listening. Is also in this one as
well.
If Zoe
Kazan is listening?
Zoe Kazan, if you're listening, I love you.
Please hang out with me.
Yeah, if you want to hang out, this is my phone number.
Can I say...
And then Brendan Gleeson as well.
Yeah. I don't think this is a film where we need to go bit by bit through it. I think it's very much a tone piece.
But I do want to start off with, because there are six parts, I want to go across the board and I want to hear what everyone's favorite anthology part was.
Sure.
Molly, let's start with you.
Oh, God. I really liked the James Franco part, just for the man coming out from the building and yelling pan shot. I was telling Eli and Carla before the show that I watched this with my roommate and it was like 1:30 in the morning and that part happened and we died. We were rolling on the floor, paused the movie, laughing. It was so funny. I also really liked the Prospector part and I really liked Zoe Kazan's part, even though it's like arguably the saddest one.
So you just named half Iowa City. Of the movie.
Yeah.
You just,
I liked all of it. Okay.
Also, all my favorites.
Also, this movie name drops Iowa City.
Yeah.
Shout
out.
True.
Yeah.
Zoe Kazan says happened. Iowa City.
Says that she had a failed business there and she hates
her brother had a failed business there.
Okay.
Carla, what are your favorite parts?
Okay. So I was also a huge fan of the gold panning or the gold prospector. Yeah. Episode and also the first one. I mean, I was talking to like Eli and Molly about this earlier and I know y'all had some issue with it, but I thought it was like, I mean, I thought it was hilarious and just like how the colors are very like washed out. He almost kind of like already looks dead at the beginning of it, which I thought was just like great.
Which one?
The very first one.
I would say my favorite, hands down, Tom Waits gold panning. I think it is.
I would. Yeah.
It is a masterpiece.
I would say that's my favorite one as well, just because I think it's got the best story. It's got some of the just best lines.
It's got some of the best images.
Yeah.
I want to. There's a handful of things I want to address right off the bat.
Okay, I'm going to give you 2 minutes, first, 2 to 3 minutes to say your manifesto.
The first thing is that. This is probably going to be most people's only engagement with the singing cowboy genre anymore. And having read more than one book now about singing cowboys, I want to diffuse a few myths. First of all, most singing cowboy movies took place in the modern day, in the 1930s. They were largely parables about the New Deal and about businesses coming in and taking people's farms. Secondly, you should be aware that almost all singing cowboy tropes come from minstrelsy. That is their root. Something that needs to be addressed. Thirdly, these characters always seem absurd to us now, but Roy Rogers for a while was the top earning star in Hollywood, above Humphrey Bogart, above everyone else. When he went to Dublin in the late 30s, more people showed up to see him in Dublin than had ever gathered together in one place in Dublin ever, including the Pope. So this was a very significant genre. It is goofy. I do laugh when I watch them now. When I watch Tumble and Tumbleweeds and stuff, like, they are B products. And so when I watch this first part with Ballad of Buster Scruggs, there is a kind of snide distance that the episode takes from the genre itself, because it's what if the, basically the premise is what if a singing cowboy was also like the avenging angel of death and horribly violent. Which is funny. It's obviously very funny.
It's my favorite Mountain Goat song.
Yeah. Nice. But it also clearly does resonate with a love of the genre. And I think the music in it is actually very good. I think Tim Blake Nelson does a wonderful job. And I think when a cowboy gets his wig, when he trades his spurs for wigs, is such a great sequence. And it's the only part of the film that feels like it resonates with like the Big Lebowski Raising Arizona side of the Coen brothers that we don't see quite as much of anymore. And that's my piece about singing cowboys. Peter Stanfield, author of Singing Cowboy Histories, at me. Tweet at me.
You actually got that done under 2 minutes.
You're welcome.
You had 5 seconds left. All right, Carla, let's go to your takes on The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a little Coen Brothers, like, at this point. I don't know, like, Molly recommended this to me specifically, not just because we were going to talk about it, but because I love Yeehaw culture. I haven't seen a lot of, like, Westerns or whatever, but this was just, like, really cool for me. I don't know, in terms of, like, violence in it. Wasn't like keen on all of it, but just like, I don't know where I was going that. It's interesting that, I don't know, you mentioned the similarities between these and like sort of parables, and that's sort of how I thought of them, is like, you know, something in the guise of like a moral lesson that ultimately has no solution and somebody dies for no reason at the end. And I appreciated that. I don't know.
Yeah. Molly?
Yeah. Yeah, I, Eli told, let me know of this before, but I have been very biased against Westerns historically, and it's true. It's true. I have been, I'm not known for my love of Westerns, but I really love this movie a lot because it's just, I don't know. It's really good. It's really funny. I feel like it's, the characters in each one are like extremely like knowable, or like you, there's something about them that feels like transcendent, where they're just like these comic characters. And also, as I'm saying this, I just remembered this parable that I think I blocked out of my mind right after I saw it, with the one about the, like, the actor who doesn't have any limbs.
That
was really sad.
It's a huge bummer.
Yeah, and
that's
it's
why,
like,
no one picked it as their favorite part.
And it's like the second one, and it's,
yeah, third one.
Yeah, the gal who got rattled third with one. Zoe Kazan is also a huge bummer, but it's paced a little bit more tenderly.
That
yeah.
one is so strange, because I said this as I was watching it, but it seems like, I told this to my roommate who's a theater major and like an actor, that it seems like Zoe Kazan is acting as though she's on stage and everyone else is acting as though they're in a movie.
Yeah.
And no absolutely. One told Zoe Kazan that there's like a camera next to her.
But I think it works.
No, it totally works. It has like this really strange, like, distancing, like, way about it, where like Zoe Kazan's character is just like really strange. Just like very, very strange mm-hmm. in like the way that she speaks, the way that like she, like the attitude she has towards like the people around her and her dead brother.
Yeah.
That was like really, really great. Yeah. And also the last one is kind of an oddball. There's not really like a whole lot about it that's funny.
Yeah, kind of a,
it's just a dialogue scene. It's yeah, just a it big is old Coen brothers dialogue scene.
A dialogue scene that kind of diverts from I think everything else really in the movie.
Oh God, what's his name? We talk about him all the time on this show. The New Yorker, Richard Brody, compared it to it was Stagecoach meets the Phantom Tollbooth.
Oh my God.
Or the Phantom Carriage Ride, rather. Yeah, it's cool. I think it kind of overstays its welcome.
Yeah, for sure. I was like, I'm getting bored.
It's hard to make that visually.
Let's metaphorically move this Stagecoach along.
I was not bored or like got sick of like inside the Stagecoach. It was like once they got out and like everyone just spent 10 minutes like staring at each other, I was like, I know what's gonna happen. Just do it. I know what's gonna happen.
Yeah.
I think it's good. I still like it. I have one other thing I want to address, which is that I do think we'd be remiss not to have a discussion about the portrayal of indigenous people in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I do think it's a problem. I'm not gonna totally defend it. I think it's an issue that any filmmaker is going to have when they're dealing with this genre. The mm-hmm. Western is, I think Steve Neal, who's a genre scholar, said it's inherently the most political genre that American cinema has reliably offered since its founding days. And I believe that the tribes represented here are largely Comanche, but they're not really referenced as such except in passing.
Yeah, I think they mentioned Comanche once.
They mentioned Comanche, I think, in the James Franco one. They don't mention anyone at all in The Gal Who Got Rattled.
I don't think those would be Comanche.
They might be Kiowa. They might be. Yeah. I don't know.
Another Comanche in the first
one. Yeah, they are in the first one.
They might be Kiowa. They might be. I don't know where they're supposed to be. They're going to Oregon, so maybe they're more like.
I would say like Lakota Sioux.
It could be Ogallala. Yeah. I don't know, but
that's part of the problem. You don't know, and then it's just, they're kind of just like they become in the way that like in a traditional Western, where that you like you expect when you see like a Western made in like the 40s or like that there's going to be these blind spots. I did not expect it to come out of a Western made in 2018 because I'm like you have like the benefit of. Like all of these years and like all of this like scholarship and this like hindsight, you don't have to make this, but it seems like they just kind of like, well, this is what like Westerns are.
Yeah. And for
so they just become like these really faceless, like
shambling zombies.
Yeah. They're and like that like, shambling... just like come at, at
as
you.
As a form of excitement and as a form of,
and I will say
of conflict.
Yeah. And I will say like, part of my disappointment is that the rest of the film, I think, is genuinely quite self-conscious and clever about the way that it inverts the structures of the Western genre, and it just doesn't do that here.
Yeah.
And that's what I think really makes it stand out. That being said, as bad as this is to admit, I think the sequence where Arthur is shooting all the Comanche people is incredibly exciting. It's racist and vile, but it is like unbelievably well crafted just as an action spectacle, in the way that the Stagecoach sequence at the end of Stagecoach or the raids in the Searchers are genuinely incredible spectacles. But without any hindsight or commentary on it, it becomes a vehicle for racism. I do think right. I don't know if I would say this film as a whole is racist. I don't think it's on the right side. I think we need to recognize that. I think this is an example of a film that can show how powerful a tool for hegemonic power structures cinema can be. Because whereas it is quite self-critical in other respects, and it largely seems that the message of this film, if it is to have one concrete message, is that the West was largely an absurd, wild land of abandon where law and morality really had no foothold. Here it seems as if they kind of lost sight of their purpose, and mm-hmm. it is a stumbling block of the film.
That's a good point, lost sight of the purpose, because I think Molly also brought this too, where, you know, they don't really need to have these scenes with Native Americans in them.
What?
You kind of brought that up a little bit, where you the.
Well, I you don't you can I
you can
I
make mean, the case that they that doesn't need to be in there.
I mean, but all. That I think that also would be a little bit problematic, because then if you make a whole film about that, to like kind of putting yourself in conversation with the Western, and you don't have indigenous people, I feel like that's also because then you're just like pretending that like that never happened, yeah. And then that becomes like a blind spot. I think that it would be so. This film would be helped a lot, and I mean, it's all like it would be so incredibly easy to just. I mean, it's generally very easy to just not be racist and to just film this differently, like write this just a little bit differently so that it doesn't just become like these sequences. There's only mm-hmm. I think two of them.
How would you write it differently, though?
I mean, I think a really simple like solution would be to like I don't know like
include one episode that centers an indigenous yeah, character.
Want that and yeah. like. At one of the six could be about indigenous tribes. Also, I mean, the stumbling that we did at the beginning of this, where like we did not know which tribes were involved, I think that is like something that's really overlooked. Like, not like it would be really easy, but like this is like that tribe, or like I don't know. It's just it would have been relatively like simple when you have all this hindsight to just not make this film in the way that it is.
And I will say also, because you said like. You would expect something like this out of a Western from the 40s or 50s. There are some Westerns from that period that, while not getting it right, I would say are actually genuinely better on this issue than this present-day film. I would say Broken Arrow, Guns of Fort Petticoat. It's not about indigenous peoples, but the Oxbow incident is about lynching. And the Western genre, especially when you have people like Fred Zinnemann working in that genre in the 50s, who are fairly conscientious liberal types... It is very much of a genre at war with itself on this issue, because it wants to be an imperialist mythology of colonial conquest, but it also is kind of a lament for a lost way, right? There's this general melancholy to the Western genre that in order to achieve civilization, you need to exterminate people and you also need bad men to do the right thing, right? This is sort of the founding mythos of the genre. A lot of critical work and study on the genre in general sort of situates it as a myth, as opposed to something like the gangster film or any given crime film or any other genre that we might go to. Westerns are constantly invoked at this kind of mythopoetic structure. And the reality is that I think there is room for give and take, specifically on the issue of indigenous representation within this. And I know that there are a lot of indigenous filmmakers who have spoken about their love of the genre despite it. There was a really good interview with an indigenous First Nations in Canada director in one of the Toronto papers last week or 2 weeks ago. And he talked about how he genuinely felt allied with the people who were killing Native people in this film by virtue of its narrative structure and formal conventions. That's very reminiscent of what Frantz Fanon would write about when he saw Tarzan with African people in the cinema, where they would all relate to Tarzan killing African people. And we need to recognize the sort of power of these generic structures in American cinema when we're critiquing them and when we're looking at them. And so this is still a film that I really genuinely enjoyed. But I think this aspect of it is genuinely quite problematic and a real letdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other comments on that?
No, I think Eli said it well. I don't have anything else to add.
Yeah. Carla, anything else to add?
Sorry.
No, you have like really good. I don't know as much about Westerns.
No, either do I. So you're our Western. Great.
I would say, as far as the, if you like the Tom Waits one, I think the location shooting of the Tom Waits one is one of the visual highlights of the film. And it looks as if, and I can't confirm this, but it looks as if it was filmed in a part of Colorado that I've been to a few times. And there was another Western directed there in the 50s by Anthony Mann called The Naked Spur, which is Andre Bazin's favorite Western. And it is mostly about Jimmy Stewart throwing lots of rocks at people. And
that is all I want to see.
It's terrific. Does have indigenous people being killed, unfortunately.
Does Jimmy Stewart do an accent?
Yes, and he's supposed to be a big bad man.
Is it a bad accent or a good accent?
That's what I like.
I don't know.
That's
fine.
My ASMR right there.
Jimmy Stewart speaking me to sleep.
Well, Stewart actually did a number of Westerns.
Isn't that what he's like most known for? Westerns? I mean, he's most known for
at the time, yeah. Like by the 50s, he was mostly known for like Winchester 77, Broken Arrow, a number of films he did with Anthony Mann, who had mostly come from noir before then. But Naked Spur is terrific. Tons of great location shooting. With the time we have left, can we talk about how good Tom Waits is in this movie?
I was going to get into some upcoming stuff.
Can we talk about Tom Waits really quick? Because I love him so much.
He just grunts the whole time.
No,
it's good. He says Mr. Pocket and his donkey's name is Lucky. And
he kills a man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he tries to kill the man in self-defense. He doesn't just straight up murder somebody. He murders
he is shot first. And also, I really love the animals in this.
They all leave and come back when he comes out of the valley. Yeah,
I thought it was like a really good like alleyway for nature. And like as someone who like I really genuinely love nature and like being out like in like wilderness like that. I was in Colorado like this summer and. Being like next to like a mountain stream like that was like the happiest I've ever been in my entire life. And so like that was just like really cool to see, like, I don't know, almost like an allegory of like the earth heals itself. Like he came, he dug all these holes and now he has all this gold and now he's leaving. But guess what? Like, it's okay.
Honestly, for me, I got that vibe a little bit at Wildlife where I kind of, because the, at least some themes in Wildlife were this kind of this loneliness of Montana. And after being in college and kind of being like nonstop for 4 years, I kind of just want to be a little secluded.
That's kind of like talked about in this book I'm currently reading by Alice Bowman called Dead Girls, where she talks about being from Idaho and how there's like this like penchant for like horrific things and like horrific violence to happen in Idaho. And she talks about how it's because it is like so isolated that it not only does the isolation like get to you mentally, but also it's the first place that people who have these like really horrible like violent tendencies like tend to congregate because they can just be by themselves.
Ridge, baby.
Yeah. And that also seems kind of attendant to the themes of the Tom Waits section because it is the most isolating of the sequences. And I will say really quickly, I don't want to embarrass Molly, but the animals coming and going when he leaves reminds me a lot of Disney princesses. And that is an opportunity for me to say that our own Molly Bagnell had a film screen in open screen that this critic thought was very charming and clever and did great things with image and audio. And I think she should be proud.
Thank you.
It was good.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, we didn't get chance to talk about open screen, but that's okay.
It was fun.
It was fun.
It's always a fun event.
Yeah.
So let's get into our conversation on The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Like I said, that is a Coen Brothers directed, written, and produced film that is on Netflix. It is not a wide release film. They're not doing what Roma is doing, where they're doing a big wide release and then putting it on Netflix. So you can go check that
out. I gotta say, I'm a little surprised they're not, to be honest.
They're doing a wide release?
It seems like the kind of thing they could do if they wanted to.
I don't think they care.
But it makes sense with the genre. Yeah, it's a widescreen format.
Yeah, I've one of my friends is currently in London and saw this on the big screen. They like
they went like all over,
they like traveled like a very long way. Took like an hour to see it on the big screen, and they said that it was like phenomenal on the big screen.
It's shot in a very wide aspect, which doesn't always work well for televisions.
Yeah,
and like a cinerama, almost like a 2x1.
And that's why I think it'd be. That's why maybe we can talk about Roma next week, because I think that's a huge debate about Cuarón putting Roma on Netflix, a movie that should be seen on big screens that will prominently be seen on televisions.
I mean, a lot of filmmakers would say that's true of all movies.
But I don't know, with a director like making Cuarón.
And then I think it's like a different to like make a film for like theatrical release. And then like after so much time it gets put on Netflix, it's a different thing to like it like just it Netflix is just where it lives predominantly. Like yeah. you don't it's not yeah. even really meant for like a theatrical release. I think it's like an interesting choice for a director to make.
I think it's especially for Alfonso Cuarón, who I you know.
Well, we're getting into an era where directorial decisions are becoming more and more tough. About well, and about exhibition and distribution and these things that are not about production.
Yeah,
and it's interesting.
We talked a little bit about this when we talked about Mudbound.
Yeah, yeah, last year.
Yeah, but, it'd be interesting. I know me and Ross Meyer had projections that Film Scene got in a big. I mean, not, we didn't get an argument.
A 10 out of 10.
But we got into a heated conversation about Roma being on Netflix, and I know he's really passionate. He's very anti. Ross is very anti Netflix. And he's really passionate.
I mean, he doesn't have to worry because they will be gone in 5 years. Netflix? They don't make money.
Yeah, they have.
They are completely sponsored by financiers. Their model's not sustainable. Ugh,
that'll be the day.
I mean, we all hate Netflix, but we all watch it.
Anyway, yeah.
Bring back Filmstruck.
We can talk about that a little bit maybe next week. Maybe I'll convince Ross to come back on. He used to come on Banter, I think. A while ago when he was on
Bijou. Not when I was on Banter.
No, he used to be on Bijou. Oh. And I think maybe he. I'm not sure. Anyway,
what's coming up at Film Scene?
Yeah, so you cannot see Wildlife anymore, but you can still see Boy Erased, apparently. That's going to end its run.
On... Boo from the audience.
You can, but you shouldn't.
That's going to end our. That's going to end on Thursday. Last screenings of Boy Erased. This week will also continue its run of At Eternity's Gate, which is the film about Vincent van Gogh.
Do you mean Van Gogh?
I was thinking about saying that.
You're thinking about being correct?
Is that how... Okay.
And then American I decided to be wrong.
Can you just let me speak and give the upcoming shows? At Eternity's Gate.
This poor guy.
We'll at least probably be here through Thursday. I think Border will be done on Thursday. I cannot say that with 100% certainty. But both those films, Border and At Eternity's Gates, both opened on last Friday. And they will be at least continuing their runs through Thursday. I'm not sure what Border's about. It's about a woman who works at the Canadian border, I think.
Or no,
Swedish. She's worse at this, like the Swedish border.
Yeah, you were right when you said you didn't know what this film is.
No one knows a lot about Border.
It's one of those that the trailer tells you absolutely nothing.
Yeah. And no one wants to tell you about it. But some exciting news. Friday will be the release of Roma at Film Scene, Friday, December 14th. We might possibly do that next week. We'll see how that goes going forward. But that will only be here for 1 week. So Roma... Friday to Friday, I believe. It's only gonna be a 1 week release. A lot of publications came out this week with their top 10 movie reviews, and I saw Roma at the top a lot of those lists. So definitely a movie to watch out for. Like I said, Alfonso Cuarón of Children of Men, Gravity,
Itami,
those good ones. So definitely look for that.
He did his own cinematography on this one, I think.
Yeah,
he
no Lubezki.
He usually has Lubezki. Usually has that guy that he does everything with. He's had him since Ichi Mama Tambien, at least.
Yeah, he's done like all his last ones.
Yeah, it's be interesting to see. I think it might genuinely end up looking pretty different because Lubezki's got that thing where he kind of cradles the camera like a baby and rocks it back and forth in a way. I don't know. Like everything baby I've time. Seen from this film looks different.
Yeah. So those are the upcoming releases at Film Scene. There is no more Bijou programming this year. We will be announcing that, I believe, in January about the new programming coming up for the next semester. So no more Bijou events this year. Check us out in January. We might be back next week, but we'll be for sure be back the first week when school starts back up in January. If you missed any other Bijou Banter episodes, go check us out on bijou.uiowa.edu. Go to our podcast or go to the blog and check out all the past episodes on Bijou Banter.
You can also get this on iTunes.
Yes.
You can, yeah.
Or any affiliate iTunes. Podcast catcher.
Yeah, I think it's just easier to go to the website.
It is.
Is it?
Yeah.
I didn't have any trouble.
Well.
Anyway, that is going to be all for Bijou Banter today. For Eli, Carla, and Molly, my name is Sam McCrory. You guys have a good rest of your night. We will see you possibly next week.